Future-proof extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
We humans aren't very fearsome on the face of it. We're slow, we're quite weak, we don't have any sharp claws or teeth. So what is the secret of our hunting successes over many millennia? Well, you might think it's down to intelligence, but a new paper suggests it may have as much to do with sweaty persistence as anything else. Eugene Moran is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at Trent University and a co-author of the paper. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Eugene. Can you just set the scene for us as to who we're talking about in this particular study? We're talking about Homo sapiens over what period of time?
Well, we're talking about, in fact, Homo sapiens, but including their ancestors, so probably Homo erectus, perhaps also, even the earlier Australopithecines could have been involved. So we're talking about the early parts of our human evolution.
Okay. And so what did your paper look at exactly?
Well, we're revisiting a debate that was opened in the 1980s. And the debate was simple. When you compare humans with other mammals, there are some features that are striking in terms of our physiology. Mm. First feature is that unlike other mammals, we can sweat a lot, almost, up to 4 liters for a marathon runner. And wow. So this is unusual for mammals. Most mammals, they will build up heat and they will collapse under heat. And so that's one very important feature. And another important feature is that our muscles related to locomotion, they're dominated by slow twitch rather than fast twitch fibers, which means basically we'll build up for stamina rather than pure power.
Right. Explain the difference between those two muscles.
So the slow twitch muscles, they are, better at long, prolonged activities, whereas the fast twitch fibers, they're perfect for, like heavy lifting or, for sprints. Exactly. So we possess more of the slower ones.
Right. Okay. And that's generally accepted that we have more of these slow twitch muscle fibers.
Yes. Yes. And so the debate was about how do these two sets of traits, come up to evolve in humans. And one possible scenario, or I would say the most likely scenario, is that it's related to a prolonged activity that humans are performing. And there are very few activities that would qualify, one of which is endurance hunting, which is basically running an animal until it collapses, because it's completely exhausted.
Right.
It could also be related to scavenging, but hunting is probably a more reasonable locus to look for this kind of a feature.
Okay, so this is interesting. We're trying to figure out why we have these features. The sweating, of course, a feature that allows us to stay cool while exercising, as opposed to other animals that can't do that and they have to stop to get their breath, otherwise they overheat. And so we have these physical traits that we're trying to figure out how and why they evolved. And one of the theories was that it was this so-called endurance hunting. Now, can you tell me what methods humans used to get food over the past few millennia? Do we know for sure? How do we have records of that?
Well, first, concerning the hunting part, we have the bones of different animals. For instance, in Africa would be wildebeest or gemsbok or eland. And so when we look at these bones, we can see marks created by tools, for instance, stone tools used in slicing motion. And these leave little tiny marks that can be identified under the microscope or used in the hand lens. So we know for sure that they were exploding meat. We also see the percussion marks made when they're, extracting marrow from these bones. So we know they're using, these animals that they're extracting meat and marrow from them. Mm. And so the question was, how did they acquire these animals? And so there's, a range of methods that can be used, but one of which involves endurance hunting. And to picture how, endurance hunting works, you can, the analogy I use is that of a car. Humans, they have an excellent radiator. So that means they can run and run and they will dissipate heat. Whereas animals like a cheetah, for instance, it's like a Ferrari, but with no radiator. It can go super fast, but it will be short bursts of sprints. And then the animal is in overheat and must stop on the side and, try to rest. So right. what humans do in these hunts typically is that they run after the animal. When they see animal, they spook them. The animal, you know, go for another sprint. They catch up with them again. They, you know, spook them again, and so on. And it's the sprint rest cycle that leads the animal into overheat. And this can take a few hours to a few days.
But that makes no sense to me as a, you know, when we talk about evolution, we often talk about the evolutionary cost and the benefit. And the cost of running after an animal for hours seems way too high compared to something like, for example, hiding and being an ambush predator, or perhaps even setting traps. Setting traps take almost no energy. Why on earth would we evolve this really exhausting sounding way of catching meat?
Well, that's a good point. So the model, when it was presented in the 80s, there were two issues that were raised against it. One was that there was little ethnographic support for it. There was few at hunter-gatherer society seemed to perform it. The other thing is that it was seen as overly, you know, expensive in terms of cost, in terms of energy involved in the activity. And in fact, what we show in our paper, we have two main results. A first result is that we show that running, despite this, you know, being more costly, the fact that it reduced the, you know, the duration of a hunt significantly, sometimes at half the time that is needed to get the animal, well, this result in, you know, very, very important gain in terms of calories. So, and also it increases the success. When you walk after an animal, you're likely to, you know, to fail. And so when you run after it, you increase the odds of getting the animal. So in other words, the gains are dwarfing the cost, the metabolic cost associated with running. And in fact, people run habitually, don't feel it's a major cost. It's because most Westerners, you know, are not very fit. And for that, you know, for most of people, it feels like really, really expensive in terms of metabolic energy. But for people who run habitually, you know, who are used to this kind of life, this is not so costly. And our second result is that we show that something that was perceived as being anecdotal or marginal in the ethnographic record, well, if you go deeper in the what we call the ethnohistorical record, that is, you know, records.
Sorry, did you say ethnohistorical record?
Yeah, ethnohistorical
record. That's a real nerdy word. Go on.
Yes. So basically, it means before we have professional ethnographers. So that would be pre-1950, 1930s, and so on. So basically, you know, think about the records left by the Jesuits, by the missionaries, the travelers, the
ancient texts, stories, and so on that aren't really structured to study people, but give us an account, however subjective, of what life was like at a certain time.
Exactly.
Time from stuff from the Romans and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. So these records contain many, many accounts of hunts that are compatible or consistent with endurance hunting. And they're way more frequent in that literature than in the recent ethnographic record. And the reason for this is that the recent ethnographer often, you know, were in, you know, studying people where you already using traps, steel traps or rifles. And these things will, you know, make endurance hunting less interesting in terms of energy budget.
Yeah, absolutely. If I want to kill an animal, am I going to run after it for 2 hours, or am I going to shoot it with a gun? There's not much of a comparison there in terms of energy cost. But we haven't talked about traps, because even back in the Stone Age, traps surely would have been a much less energy intensive way of catching your meat. How do we square that?
That's also an excellent point. So the problem with traps is that traps must be monitored. You have to put a lot of them, and many will fail. So often the time involvement in them is a cost, and it's a significant cost. You can be 10 days without catching anything. Hmm. The other problem is that many animals become trap wary. For instance, the elephants, you know, if you put a pit, you know, once they almost fell into a pit there, they become very, very wary of traps. And so they become extremely difficult to catch. So traps.
Do we know that though? I mean, that seems like a good theory, but, you know, with evolutionary biology, it's always great if you have experimental science along with it. Have you been able to create traps and see how quickly animals learn?
Well, it's the ethnographic record that comes to help here, because we have natives telling us, you know, we have put pits, but, you know, we have not cut anything with it for 6 months or something like that. So we have some, you know, I would say substantial ethnographic support for the fact that traps may work sometimes for a short burst of time. You know, maybe let's say you have a year where there are lots of rabbits around. Well, in those years or in these short periods, they may work well. And then for months, you may not catch anything.
Right. I guess even if they weren't used to the traps, you still have to. You wouldn't have your trap in the village or where the humans were gathering, because that's not where animals would be. So you have to travel to the trap. You have to dig the trap. And then you may not actually catch anything with that trap. So the energy costs sort of make sense.
And also in the open environment, traps, you know, they're really difficult to set up, you know, because the animals, there's no trees there.
Yeah.
So if you're in an arid environment, traps don't work really well.
Okay. So when you were trying to come up with evidence to substantiate this hypothesis that we have evolved some of these traits due to endurance hunting, how much data can you really get on that? I mean, how many books are there written before 1920s about endurance hunting, really?
Well, I've been quite a, I would say, I went all bit berserk with that. And so I downloaded something like 8,000 documents. So again, wow. Mostly, you know, travelogues, you know, missionaries' reports, missionary accounts, and government reports. And these documents, you know, these 8,000, well, I searched through them with some keywords and with the script, you know, what we call a proximity script. So I would say, look for running and deer. And so I would then manually check the, you know, what the software was pulling out. And then, you know, looking whether this is consistent with encounter hunting, with trapping, ambush hunting, or with hindrance hunting.
But that's how do you search that many texts?
Well, the software will skim for you. So you don't read the whole thing. You just read the paragraph that is related to the search. And so you are going to miss quite a few, but you will find stuff that you would not find otherwise. So, but again, a lot of time.
Yeah.
That's research. Huh? Research is just spending a lot of time.
Okay. So when we look at humans across the globe over this period, Homo erectus and a little bit before perhaps, and all of the living history of Homo sapiens, do we feel that there is enough? Because isn't it true that these evolutionary traits come out from, you know, from adapting to in intense pressure, like a bird develops a longer beak when there's no more food for short beak birds? It doesn't something as drastic as being able to sweat in the way that we can do that's so unusual. Doesn't that have to come from a severe biological pressure? Is that there, an environmental pressure? Is that, do we have evidence that that existed to force us to evolve that sweating?
Well, you put it a very interesting way here. So if you look at the bonobos or chimpanzees, for instance, chimpanzees, they are known to hunt collectively after red colobus monkey. Okay, so they're going, let's say, 10 of them, they go into trees and they will scare the animal and they will try to catch it. And there will be some people, you know, some chimps that there will be another tree and will intercept the animal. So in some ways, this is not too far from running after the animal. So you can expect that if this is a successful strategy, you know, well, those individuals who are faster and more endurance, yeah, you know, more endurance than others, you can see, you know, some, you know, a locus for selection here that would on the long term pay off. In this case, they're going after small animals in the trees, but you can imagine that they're doing this also on the ground. For instance, we know that chimps can hunt small duikers, which are small antelopes, so they run it on the ground. So you can see an expansion from such a, you know, like this, like you can see that as a preliminary endurance hunt. It's very short, it's more of a sprint, but you can imagine there would be selective pressure for, you know, the more, you know, the chimps with more stamina or the primates with more stamina to be more successful on the long term. And this could result in the evolution of the trait.
Yeah. And this is, I guess, for me, the trouble with evolutionary biology, because it's tricky to prove that, isn't it? We can certainly imagine scenarios where we might develop a certain trait or a certain physical attribute as a result of an environment changing and forcing us to evolve through natural selection. But is it really difficult to prove? Like, what has been the response to your paper saying, look, it looks pretty clear that endurance running is something that may have led to these traits?
Well, these are all good points. So we have to think sometimes in terms of parsimony. So again, if you look at these traits, we have these physiological traits. There are very few activities that qualify. And as I said, endurance hunting would be one. The other thing is that our papers show that the cost, the activity itself in terms of energy is rewarding. We compared, you know, we calculated with some quantitative data from the ethnographic record. We show that this strategy in certain contexts can be as, if not more, rewarding than other forms of hunting. Mm. So at least we showed it's possible. Yeah. And in fact, it's rewarding. And then when we look at the ethnohistorical record and we look at the range of environments where it was practiced, this also comes as support. You know, they're both, you know, going in the same direction, showing that this is a valid, productive strategy. And we can explain how it evolved if we take into account the context in which they were performed.
All right. Okay. I want to finish up with this question, because in the paper, you refer to a number of different accounts from colder regions where humans would run on the snow for hours to come. And I'm wondering, how is that possible? How do you run on the snow to hunt prey that is much better adapted to the snow, you would imagine?
Yes. Well, the problem is that this kind of hunting is, again, performed in very specific contexts. Deep snow, especially with the crust of ice on it. In fact, wolves use the same strategy. What happened is that it's a difference of weight. If you run after a moose, moose is 600 kilograms. So the crust will not hold the weight of the moose. But 600 kilo, the 50 kilogram of a hunter gatherer on snowshoe, well, that means the person can basically glide on the crust. So whereas the animal is bouncing from one set of holes to another set of holes that it's creating while running, humans run on the crust. And in this way, humans can get, you know, we have some accounts where they say when the crust is just perfect, even children can get a moose, because the moose will cut his legs going through the crust while bouncing from one, you know, while trying to escape the predator.
Right. So it's not like powder snow in these environments. The ideal conditions are sort of thicker snow where it's kind of crunchy, like a ice on the top, which would support a lighter human.
Well, we have evidence for both. Sometimes it's just deep snow. But again, with deep snow, if you have, you know, legs with, you know, the coverage you have with the foot is small relative to a snowshoe. So even in deep snow, it's working. Right. But the best is on crusted snow because the animal hurt its leg while running.
All right. Interesting. Really interesting. And thank you so much for your time. And that is Professor Eugene Morin. He's from the Department of Anthropology at Trent University, talking there about endurance hunting. Thanks for your time, Eugene.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.